We have a massive problem. You have a massive problem, in case you were curious. I'll tell you what that problem is. Okay? It's a problem that plagues all of us. It's a problem that is a nasty thing that creeps into all of our lives regularly. It causes you to doubt. It causes you to lack hope in your life. And it causes you to daily offend God. That problem is that we are all forgetful people. We all forget. We all forget the works of God. We all forget the majesty of the person of Jesus. We all forget that if we believe that the Bible is true, that He is working all things for our good and His glory. We forget these things. We're forgetful people. Maybe what that means is that we need to learn how to stack stones. Chapter 4 in the book of Joshua is all about memorializing something. It's about creating a monument to remember. It's about creating a way so that you don't forget, or so that the people of God did not forget. But within this passage, I just want to be very clear, there are some pretty tricky and major theological points that need to be addressed. There's some deeply practical ideas here. There's also some language things that we'll have to address a little bit without getting too in the weeds about it. But there's two very important interpretive messages for us. There's two very clear things. Number one, what are they supposed to remember? What are the people of God supposed to remember in this passage? And what are you and I supposed to remember? And number two, who was supposed to remember? What are they to remember? Who was to remember? These are actually split into two different pieces in the text. You've got section 1, which is verses 1 to 7. That's what are they supposed to remember? And then section 2, verses 8 to 24, who is supposed to remember it? Section 1 answers the first question. Section 2 answers the second question. Just as a spoiler, though, I'm going to give you a little spoiler alert. Okay, there's one application for this entire passage, and I'm going to tell you right now. Reflect on your life. Okay? Be very thoughtful about your life. I call it a self-audit. Audit your life. Think about it. Reflect on it. And then compare that reflection to this passage. It's a very interesting thing, structurally speaking, in Joshua chapter 4, because literarily it's designed in those two sections. Those two sections are actually about the same event. It says it once and then repeats the same event. It's the only chapter in the book of Joshua that repeats the same event twice. It's not the only place where it's repeating things, right? Chapter 1, we saw Be Strong and Courageous repeated 3 times. In chapter 3, we saw Ark of the Covenant repeated 7 times. It's not the only place where it's repeating things. It's the only place in the book that an event is mentioned and then immediately mentioned again. I think the reason for that is drilling into the reader, drilling into you and I, that we are forgetful. So it said it. Oh, by the way, you forgot already. I'm going to say it again. And it's creating this sense of remember, 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 remember. So what are they to remember? Section 1. You got basic information here at the beginning, verses 1 to 5, give or take. 12 stones are chosen. These are the same 12 people that are chosen in chapter 3, verse 12. Whenever they're crossing the Jordan, the command goes out and it says, Joshua, choose 12 people. Okay, there's 12 people here. It's the same people. So choose 12 people. And here's what I want those 12 people to do, God says. Make sure to get a big stone from the middle of the Jordan so that whenever you cross, you can set up a monument. Pretty straightforward information. That's what's happening here, and Joshua is commanding those things. But then we see something very, very interesting in verses 6 and 7. In verses 6 and 7, we have a structural literary feature. Okay, big word. It's called a chiasm. Okay, or a chiasmus, if you want to use that word. Okay, this is a literary feature used often in Hebrew narrative to create a focal point. Okay, the Greek letter chi looks like an X. It's an X. So a chiasm is one half of that. Starts wide and then correlates down to a focal point. So if you read 6 and 7, so this will be a sign among you in the future when your children ask, what do these stones mean? You should tell them the waters of the Jordan was cut off in front of the Ark of the Covenant, the Lord's Covenant. When it crossed the Jordan, the Jordan's water was cut off. Therefore, these stones will always be a memorial for the Israelites. So you've got one and the end is basically correlating. So this will be a sign among you in the future when your children ask. And at the end, this will be a memorial for the Israelites. And then the next step in, what do these stones mean? And then at the end, it's these stones will always be a sign. And then the next step in, the waters of the Jordan was cut off. And then at the end, the Jordan's water was cut off. And then you've got the two phrases right in the middle. They were cut off in front of the Ark of the Lord's Covenant. And then right next to it, when it, the Ark of the Lord's Covenant, crossed the Jordan. So you've got this literary feature. That's a lot of technical stuff, and I get it. It's a literary feature that focuses your attention to the fact of what they're supposed to remember. It is not remember when you crossed the Jordan. It is not remember when the water was stopped. It was not, remember the Levites carrying the ark. What were they supposed to remember? The ark going in front of them. They were supposed to memorialize the action of God in the crossing of the Jordan. The activity of the Lord. What we said in chapter 3 last week was the presence of God was visible in the ark. God moved, ark moved. Ark moved, God moved. It's kind of how that's set up. So God in the ark moving across the Jordan is the Lord leading them across the ark or across the Jordan. So for them to memorialize in front of the ark of the Lord's covenant, for them to memorialize this was not to memorialize anything they did. It was to memorialize what God did. They set up 12 stones to remember the activity of God, not their own. And that's the first reflective question for you. In your own story, who gets credit? Do you get credit? Or does God get credit? Your own story of salvation, coming to faith in the Lord. What does Titus 3:5 say? Not by works of righteousness which you have done, but according to his mercy he saved you. Have you ever read that in the text of Genesis chapter 6 with Noah and the flood? Genesis chapter 6, it starts out by saying this: everybody's wicked. Everybody is wicked, and they do wickedness continually, the text says. Everybody. But then, just like in the book of Esther, it says, but Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. Was there anything redeeming about Noah? I would argue he's included in that everybody does wicked continually. But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. When Jesus came to earth and died on the cross for the forgiveness of sins, He did not provide a way for you to participate in your salvation. He provided a way for God to save you. Your salvation, your coming to faith, is not working together with God. It's not synergistic in that sense. It is monergistic, if you want to put that word to it. It is God saving you. Yes, you might say, okay, I responded in faith. Yeah, you did. Who gave that to you, though? Who gave you that faith to respond in? You didn't spawn it, right? Ephesians chapter 2, for by grace you have been saved through faith. It is a gift. It is referring to the grace and the faith. The grace is a gift from God and the faith is a gift from God that we respond in. But who gets praise for your salvation? Who gets credit for that in your life? When you talk about your testimony, you talk about your story of moving into salvation, who's the primary actor? Also consider your own spiritual life, your pursuit of holiness, your progress in sanctification. Who gets credit for that? This is the relationship between what Paul writes in Philippians 2:12 and what he writes in the very next verse in 2:13. We always stop at verse 12. Therefore, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. But what does verse 13 say? For it is God who is working in you, both to will and to work according to his pleasure. So who gets credit for your pursuit of godliness? Is it you? Or is it God working in you? What were they supposed to memorialize? Who's the hero of the Israelites crossing the Jordan? Were they to set these 12 stones up and just say, oh, praise, you know, Joshua that he led us across the Jordan? No, praise God that he led us across the Jordan. Were they supposed to set these 12 stones up and say, oh, I'm really glad that we were able to cross? No, it was to remember the Lord leading them across. It was to remember the activity of God in their life. That's what they were supposed to remember. Who was supposed to remember it, though? Who was supposed to remember it? And this is where we get into some of the language stuff. So I'm going to try really hard not to get into the weeds in this. Okay? This is what caused great frustration and difficulty throughout the preparation of this. It was very difficult. Because if you read the beginning section, it says, okay, there's a monument at Gilgal. Okay? And then you read at the end, there's a monument at Gilgal. But then if you read verse 9, Joshua also set up 12 stones in the middle of the Jordan where the priests who carried the Ark of the Covenant were standing. That reads like there's two monuments. That reads like he took 12 people, told them to gather stones, bring them to Gilgal, and set up the monument. But then Joshua also set up a monument in the middle of the river. There's a problem, though. God only commanded one monument. And we also see at the end of the chapter, Joshua setting up that monument. So what's happening here? What's going on? Okay. The literal reading of this text, if you were to take Hebrew directly into English, it reads like this. 2:10 stones set up Joshua, Jordan, midst. That's what it reads. Okay? That's it. So there's quite a bit of interpretive flexibility with what's happening there. Okay, but here's what we can say. There's two things going on. There's a verb and there's a preposition. Okay? This verb, hakim, okay, it means to set up. That's what it means. Okay? Some people are like, oh, Hebrew, it's really complicated. It means to set up. just like a really easy word. Okay? It's a verb to set up. But then you have the word betoke, which is a preposition that means in the midst. Okay? It's the same word that's in Genesis when it talks about the tree being in the midst of the garden. Okay? The complicated thing is, whenever you put these two forms together, it could read set up in the middle of the river. It also could read, and this is the interpretive flexibility, the stones that had been in the middle of the river, where the priests had been standing. So it's a little bit tricky. Here's what I want you to keep in mind. Can you trust the text written in your Bible? Yes, because it's a very valid and very true translation. Is there also room to say maybe there's a little bit of nuance here that makes it make a little bit more sense? Yes, there is. So when you read this and you say, okay, did Joshua set up a second monument? That doesn't seem to fit with the text. Maybe there's a solution to it. And I would argue linguistically that there is a solution to it. That there's one monument, but the way this is translated, it makes it read like there's two. But I would argue that there's one monument based on the way these words go together. I wanted to point that out because it seems complicated whenever you're reading the text. It seems like there's multiple things going on here. But it also plays into who was supposed to remember. Was Joshua going rogue in making this second monument in the middle of the river? No, because it doesn't have any function in the narrative of who's supposed to remember what's going on. So who's supposed to do it? In the beginning section, where we just talked about, the command came from Joshua in verse 8, but it also came from the Lord in verse 10. And in verse 10, we also see that the command came from Moses. So it came from Joshua, the Lord, and Moses. And then what we see is that in verse 12, the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh were also present there, even though they already had their allotted land on the east side of the Jordan. But they're still part of the nation of Israel. Then in verse 19, what we see is this union of when they crossed the first day or the 10th day of the first month. This is all pointing to the union of Israel in this act of deliverance. All the people of God were together for this event. They were acting as a single organism, a united people of God. This is confirmed even more with that date in verse 19. They crossed on the 10th day of the first month. That is not January 10th. Okay, different calendar. Okay, it's actually more like the 2nd of April. Okay, the month is called Nisan, which is a very important thing to remember, because whenever we look back at Passover in the law, in the book of Exodus, Passover takes place on the 15th day of Nisan, the 15th day of the first month. The preparation for Passover starts on the 10th day of the first month. So the crossing of the people of Israel across the Jordan into the promised land is the same day they were supposed to start preparation for celebrating Passover. There's a unity in the people of God. There's also a pointing here to the fact that they're celebrating and setting up a monument for the deliverance of God, also getting ready for a monument about the deliverance of God in the Passover. All of this is taking place at the same time. So every single time they were to look at these 12 stones stacked at Gilgal, the entire generation present of Israel was supposed to remember this. Everybody, the whole community, coinciding with another event of remembering. It's like, by the way, you forgot. Look at the stones. Oh, by the way, you forgot. Look at Passover. Oh, by the way, you forgot. It's for everybody. Because we're forgetful people. But look back at verse 21. What does it say? In the future, when your children ask their fathers. So who's supposed to remember? The present generation of the Israelites. The people alive then. Who else is supposed to remember? The next generation of the Israelites. This is assuming a few things. It's assuming, one, the fathers know what the stones mean. It's also assuming the children ask the fathers what the stones mean. This is Jewish culture. This is the culture of the people of God through the Old Testament, where the family discipleship was so integrated into the life of the believer, into the life of the covenant person, that children and fathers and mothers and siblings and aunts and uncles were all together remembering the stories of God all the time. It's an oral culture, which we forget. We don't have an oral culture. We have a text-driven culture. You want to share information with somebody, what do? You send an email, send a text. You know, what's the best way to get a message across? You write a book about it, right? In Jewish culture, that was not the case. The best way to get a message across is you would tell somebody, and then they'd tell somebody, and then they'd tell somebody, and then they'd tell somebody. The best way to disciple your family was not to sit down and read the book. The best way to disciple your family was to tell stories of the mighty works of God. Which is what it's assuming here. When your children ask, what are these stones about? Tell them to remember the mighty work of God. So who's supposed to remember? The generation of Israel present is supposed to remember. The next generation of Israel is supposed to remember. And then look at verse 24. This is so that all peoples of the earth may know that the Lord's mighty hand, and so that you will always fear the Lord your God. So the present generation is to remember, the next generation is to remember, and all the people of the earth are to remember. That's quite a statement. Do you think all the peoples of the earth were going to Gilgal looking at 12 stones stacked up? Probably not. Because that'd be crazy. I've never been to Gilgal, but I've heard about the mighty work of God that came from someone who experienced the mighty work of God, who had remembered it and then told me. This is supposed to be a monument of remembering, not a physical idol to remember at. You're supposed to remember the work of God. So who's supposed to remember? The generation present, the next generation, and all the peoples of the earth. There is spiritual formation tied into it. There is family discipleship tied into it. And there is evangelism tied into it. But this has a few very important implications. A few very important. Again, the application of this, reflect on your life. But here's the first implication. It implies that there's stories passed between people. It implies that there's stories passed between people. I was speaking with someone the other day who's a storyteller here in the Valley. Okay, and by story, I use that, you know, very specifically, like a middle-aged bard or something. Like he writes stories, he tells stories, he does like radio theater. Like he's a storyteller. That's what he does professionally. And this is what he was saying, quote, "To tell stories to other people is to then become accountable to them because it's no longer your story, it's their story." What that means whenever you experience the work of God in your life and you share it with somebody here, it becomes a communal, so it's your experience, but it becomes a communal reality. Now everyone is remembering the work of God. They saw it in you, you shared it with them, now they're encouraged and their faith grows. And then they can share it with somebody else and say, oh look, their story. It becomes a communal reality. When we remember and we share the stories of God in our lives. So what's important about sharing our stories about coming to faith? How do we come to faith? Look what God did. Second thing that this implies is that these stories are passed on to our children. It's not if your children ask in the text. It says when your children ask. Okay? This is implied that families are being intentional about discipling and bringing these things up. Okay? It's very easy. Parents, I understand. It is very easy to be very passive about discipleship. It's very easy. It's very easy to say, I'm tired. It's very easy to say, we had a busy day. It's very easy to say, woke up on the wrong side of the bed. I don't really want to do this. It's very easy. And it's another thing, it is also very wicked. Because it is neglecting the spiritual discipleship of your family. It is not passing the stories or the works of God onto the next generation that's intended to remember them. Yes, we do stuff here at church. It's not our job. It's not our job to disciple your children. Or mine. It's my job to disciple my children. But it implies that. It implies that specifically, this is my sense of the text and the whole Bible, specifically fathers, it implies that. It implies that. It says it twice in the text. When your children ask, fathers, tell them. When your children ask, fathers, tell them. I think that is repeated throughout the Old Testament and into the New Testament. You can disagree with me if you want to, and I would just say, where's it written? My sense of the entire Bible is that it is the father's responsibility primarily to disciple their family, to function in the sense that they represent Christ to their family. And that's what we see here, memorializing the activity of God crossing the Jordan. And the third thing that this implies is that these stories of the work of God are intended to be shared outside the people of God, for the sake of memorializing being evangelistic. Think about it like this, okay? Have you ever seen street preachers that walk up to people, maybe not, this is Northeast Wisconsin. Have you ever heard of street preachers that walk up to people and they're like, have you ever lied? Yeah. Have you ever killed somebody? No. Well, what does Jesus say? Right, if you hate somebody, you killed them in your heart. You need Jesus. Right, that's a way to do it, right? There's a real important guy who runs a ministry called Way of the Master. He's seen a lot of productive evangelism happen that way. But imagine a story-driven culture where your primary evangelism is not, remember how wicked you are. Let me show you how not to be wicked anymore. What if it's, God, can I buy you a cup of coffee and tell you how good the Lord is in my life? That might change a conversation. And then you share a story remembering the faithfulness of God. And then at that point, what you're doing is you're doing exactly what John does in 1 John 1, 1 and 2, where he says, what I have seen with my eyes, heard with my ears, touched and experienced with my own hands, this I now declare to you concerning the word of life. Right? That's the whole letter of 1 John is saying, I touched Jesus. I saw him. I heard him. Let me tell you how great he is. It's not rote information anymore. This is an evangelistic strategy saying, I set up 12 stones with my own hands. Why? To remember the work of God in my life, bringing me into rest. That's a very different way to go about evangelism. It's also really easy because guess what? You don't have to make anything up. You don't have to know the right words. What do you have to do? Have an experience of God. The end. Those are the three implications of this passage. It's implied that these stories are shared between people. It's implied that they are shared with your children. And it's implied that they are shared beyond the community of the people of God. So I would encourage you as we end. Parents, take your family worship seriously. Take it seriously. If you need help with that, talk to me. I will help you with that. I'm not saying I do it great. I'm saying I can help you with it. I would also encourage everyone here to pass your stories of God's faithfulness among each other. Share your stories with each other that we can grow together and become mutually faithful together in remembering the faithfulness of God. Share your stories with each other. This is the whole point of Joshua chapter 4. The whole point. They were brought by God into the promised land. They were brought from wilderness and struggling into the land promised for rest by the work of God. God did it, and they were beneficiaries of his work. Therefore, the whole point, how were they to go about remembering throughout the generations the work of God among them? How do you do that? What do you have set up in your home? There's some questions on the back of the bulletin that I've provided for you to kind of think through this. Are there things in your lives that are set up to remember the work of God? We are forgetful people. We must find ways to remember the work of God in our lives. And we must remember that he saves us, that he works in us, and we must pass it on to develop a community of remembering in the Lord. Let's pray. Father, thank you for being a God that wants us to remember. Thank you for giving us the ability to remember things, to remember the work that you have done in us and through us and among us. God, I pray that you would quicken our souls here by your Spirit to share your works in our lives among each other. I pray that you would encourage and fortify parents here to press this deeply into the souls of their children by your word. God, I pray that we would be a people that desire and seek out opportunities to sit down with those outside of your grace and share what you have done in us with them. God, I praise you for this passage that we can so clearly see that we are forgetful. Help us in that, God, in your name. Amen.